Hey, it's Amelia, aka Big Tit.
And I'm Natasha, aka Little Tit.
And together, we're the Graveyard Girls.
Hello. Welcome to today's episode.
Yes, and it's one of mine.
It is.
And this one, I kind of took the inspiration from someone made a comment on one of our videos. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, actually, the point they made was quite interesting. So I thought I'd go and do a case around it. So I basically shared a reel of some images from a book called Murder Maps.
Murder Maps, yes. Yeah. You've told me about this book before.
Yeah, it's written by a person called Dr. Drew Gray. And it basically looks at crimes from the 1800s into the 1900s. So basically a Victorian era.
Yep.
And it's the beginning part of the book. It looks at different ways that they would have identified criminals and how they solved crimes and basically how it changes within that century. So I kind of wanted to have a little look at this. So this episode is going to be solving murder cases in the 1800s and how did they go about it and how did things change.
Okay, that's a long title.
No, that's not the whole title, but it's, yeah, it's basically like solving murder cases in the 1800s.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, I'm basically going to be looking at how it changes through mm-hmm. that century. So obviously for us now, it's easy to sort of sit back and go, well, how did they not solve that? Like, it seems quite obvious to us. Or why didn't they just do this in this way? But obviously what we seem to forget is how very few tools the police actually had at the time for solving murder cases. So in a lot of the cases, unless there was an actual witness or something really obvious, a lot of it went unsolved.
Well, yeah.
It's also a time of industrial revolution, so there's a lot of people moving about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy for murderers to murder someone and then just dump it somewhere and then disappear.
And it's also like, how do you know what's an accident, what's a murder?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So obviously, as we know, things like DNA testing, or even that's relatively new now, that only appeared around, I think it was 1986. So going back all the way to 1800s, we didn't have things like DNA, so you were very, very limited to there could be a wealth of evidence. Obviously, the DNA existed. We didn't know how to use it in the 1800s.
No.
So before I go a bit more into the deeper part of solving murders in the 1800s, I want to share with you a few important sort of milestones. So from the beginning of the 1800s to 1900, it's kind of important parts. And then afterwards, I'll go into a bit more detail on some of them.
Okay.
So it's a timeline, basically. So starting off in 1814, Matthew Ofila published his work on poisons and how they can be detected.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously this time is when a lot of people have been poisoned.
Oh, is this where the French names are going to be coming in?
Yeah, I'm okay. Not going to lie. I'm going to butcher a lot of these names because there's a lot of French and German and Austrian names.
So okay.
Obviously, because these are the founding fathers of everything.
Of
because
the forensics.
Yeah, so as British people aren't very good at starting things, so we take it off everyone else. So I'm going to have to just butcher these names. Joseph von Fraunhofer, I think, invented the spectroscope, which would become a vital tool in forensic analysis. This is also in 1814. Then in 1821, a police lineup is used for criminal identification for the first time in England.
Mm.
In 1823, Jean Evalangist,
yeah.
Yep. Porcain identifies 9 fingerprint patterns, including arches, loops, and whorls.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1829, Sir Robert Peel establishes the Metropolitan Police Service in London.
Oh, I was going to say, I know that name.
Yeah. Very important man.
It is.
And in 1831, criminologist Adolf Quetelet, I'm going with that,
Okay. Publishes
the statistical study of crime.
Mm-hmm.
In 1835, Scotland Yard's Henry Goddard matches a bullet to its mould for the very first time.
Ooh.
Yeah. Then in 1836, James Marsh creates a test able to detect tiny amounts of arsenic. So he's obviously used the study done all the way back in 1814, taken that guy's book and has started developing tests. Then in 1836, the Medical Witness Act allows British coroners to conduct autopsies into suspicious deaths, because up until that point, the only autopsies done, they had to ask permission from the family first. So this now allows it that if the medical like examiner, well, it wasn't an examiner at this time, it would have just been the doctor. If he goes, oh, this looks a bit suspicious, he no longer needs to ask the family's permission.
Can you imagine being like, oh yeah, no, now someone dying, and you'd be like, actually no, I don't want an autopsy, just send them straight to the...
Yeah, families can still decline it now.
Yeah.
But basically...
Well, in the Laurie Vallow Daybell, he denied an autopsy on his wife. She had to be exhumed because she did not die peacefully in her sleep.
So, well, this is it. So I think it was more as well, a lot of the time before, you know, if they just had a body and they couldn't identify it, they still didn't do an autopsy because they didn't have the family to ask them permission. Whereas this medical act now means if... the coroner suspects foul play, it can be like, okay, I can do an autopsy.
Or if there's a dead body in the street, maybe just do it anyway.
Yeah, but up until this point they couldn't. It was how the law was, so they've changed it so that if it looks a bit suspicious, the coroner can do it without having to ask permission first.
Makes sense.
Then in 1843, the first prisoner photographs were taken in Belgium. In 1850, Alan Pinkerton establishes his own private detective agency. So it's the first one. Oh, I've heard of
Pinkerton, yeah.
Yeah. So up at this point, we only had small police divisions. They didn't have their own sections. So this guy was the first private detective. Then in 1853, Ludwig Techman develops a test to determine the presence of blood in the stain. Then in 1855, Louis-Francois Etienne Berget, I think this is probably the best one I've pronounced so far, establishes a time of death using forensic entomology. In 1857, Jean-Louis Lesange publishes the results of his systematic microscopic studies of hair. Then in 1858... the New York City Police Department establishes the Rogues Gallery, which is a photographic record of known criminals. So that today would be now what we know as mugshots.
It's kind of fascinating that it's all kind of like popping up.
And all countries are doing slightly different things at this time. But eventually, obviously, because people travel between the countries, we end up bringing it back. So then in 1859, Robert Bunsen and Gustav Kirchhoff developed the spectroscopic method of identifying unknown materials, so that could be things like fibers. Then in 1862, W.V. Adams patents the first adjustable ratchet design for handcuffs. So up until that point they were all one size, and then you know now how they tighten it. This was on the first ones created. Then in 1868, the Howland forgery trial was the first time analysis of signatures was used to identify a fake signature.
So you got some handwriting experts in there.
So in 1869, the National Crime Record is set up in England. Then in 1871, Jean Michon publishes his findings on handwriting analysis. And in 1873, Alfred Swain Taylor develops processes for chemical, microscopic and optical investigations of bloodstains. So we're finally, now the microscope's here, we can look at everything in more detail. In 1877, Francis Galton layers photographs of criminals to establish the average criminal's face. So like it'd be some sort of tracing or like see through paper, and he lays it up to see if there's characteristics between all the different...
Yeah, they're thinking that there's like... a correlation between crime and how you look. That's a bit
So he's like probably one of the earliest criminologists. So then in 1877, the first police call box is installed in New York City. So up until that point we didn't have police call boxes. Then in 1878, the London Metropolitan Police introduces the Criminal Investigations Department, or CID, with 200 detectives. In 1881, Hermann Reinhardt conducts a study of insect species inside corpses. So this is where now, you know, they'd look at like different maggots and how far, like larvae and how they've produced to do a time of death. Obviously, this was the early stages of that. In 1883, the police whistle replaces the police rattle in London Metropolitan Police. So I think it was like the ones that they swing around.
I hate those.
Yeah, so do I. But it's all right. They've been replaced by the whistle. Not that that's any better. Maybe a bit quicker, I feel.
There's just someone... less effort. Tigers who always has one. So it's like... you're like, why?
In 1888, Dr. Thomas Bond's report on Jack the Ripper is the first criminal profile. Also in 1888, Alphonse Bertillon introduces rigorous regulations into the taking of mugshots. So it's like you must always do them in this pattern.
Makes sense.
And take the same size, so it's front, left, right. Up until that point, I think they were just taking a random photo of the guy, and that was it. In 1889, Alexander Le Cassange lays the groundwork for forensic science in ballistics. Also in 1889, Pauline Tarnowski is the first female criminologist and publishes a study on female criminals, which I thought was quite early
kind
of thing. So I thought that was interesting. Then in 1892, Joan Vucetic establishes the first method of recording an individual's fingerprints on file.
Oh, okay.
And in 1892, Francis Galton outlines a model for fingerprint analysis. So how you would do it. And that's where then they get the little magnifying glass and start comparing. So he writes a book on that. In 1893, Hans Gross, who is the founding father of criminal profiling, formalises the science of criminology. And in 1895, ink analysis is used to identify forged documents in the trial of James Revis. Also in 1895, Edris Petrovic publishes an important paper on blood spatter analysis. So it's quite advanced for the time. I didn't even think they looked at blood spatter at that point.
Yeah.
Also in 1895, the first facial reconstruction is done by Wilhelm His Senior. And in 1896, the police use microscopic analysis of wrapping paper to locate child murderer Amelia Dyer.
Ooh.
So obviously I've already covered a case on her, so if you want to go and have a little listen back to that. So when it's a wrapping paper, I don't think it means wrapping paper as in like wrapping up presents.
Christmas present, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the paper that would have gone around like sandwiches and packaging, okay. Just your normal paper. But yeah. It's still obviously wrapping paper.
Paper. It's just not used for gifts.
Yeah. Then in 1899, the first police dog program is introduced in Belgium.
Aww.
So that's at the turn of the century. Okay. So now that I've gone through the milestones, I want to sort of go through what crime was like in the early 1800s. And then some of these bits that I've already discussed will crop back into it.
Okay.
So obviously the Industrial Revolution was here, which meant cities were getting busier and attracting people from all over the world. With criminals mixing and finding more cunning and resourceful ways to commit crimes and avoid capture, the police were forced to become more sophisticated, and they too needed to adapt and find new ways to detect and prosecute.
Mm.
So I'm sure it's no surprise that France was leading the way in terms of detection techniques. They would establish the first private detective agency at the beginning of the century. This was led by Eugène François Vidcroix, I think. I'm really going to butcher these following names. Who was a former convict and police informer.
Mm.
He had been appointed head of the bureau in Paris and given the brief to detect crime and catch criminals. At the time, many believed that the idea that it took a criminal to catch a criminal. Because at first I was a bit very surprised, and I was like,
well,
okay.
It's kind of like what I said earlier about like knowing a killer.
Mm, exactly.
Understanding a killer.
And so Eugene was supported by a whole squad of ex-convicts. Okay.
This could go one of two ways.
This approach would continue well into the 1870s. So went on for a long time.
Okay.
As for Britain, London's Detective Department was founded in 1842 after a number of high-profile crimes had gone unsolved, as well as fears over the growing number of attempts to kill Queen Victoria, which I didn't know about.
I think there was some thing about her.
Mm. So yeah, there was a whole spate of them, and also major crimes were going unsolved. So it was a bit like, should probably do something about this. Got talking to French people, and we're like, oh, they seem to be solving their crimes all right. So whatever they're doing, we'll do that. So then CID came about in 1878, and that was after a scandal which had implicated several members of the detective department in a betting scam.
Is that the one that's full of criminals? Or just, okay.
Well, we probably did have criminals if we were taking it from the way France were doing theirs.
Oh, sorry, okay.
Yeah, we developed in the... So in 1842, we did a detective department, but then it was just that department. It did... Obviously, I think it was sort of a range of crimes. It wasn't that specific.
Okay.
Then, obviously, things were obviously all going a bit wrong. And then as CID, that was created in the height of the scandal. So that's when I think they then made more specific departments. Up until that point, even though they called it a detective department, I think it was a whole collection of officers and they didn't have a specific role.
Okay.
And then as time on, they were like, okay, no, we need to make divisions for certain crimes.
Okay.
The credit in terms of development of the modern forensic techniques should be given to a man by the name of Alphonse Bertillon, and he features a lot in this book, and a lot of the photos I've shared are all photos that have been taken by him.
Is he so, Italian? He sounds Italian.
I think, I don't know if he is Italian, but he sounds Italian.
Mm. Alphonse.
His work he's doing is in France, so
could be
it
French.
Could still be Italian, just living in France. His work came to light towards the end of the century, so obviously into the 1900s, and he was the one who quickly recognised that identity was the key to solving crime. So I think at that point, they'd just been looking for evidence, like as in like physical evidence, but I think he was the one that sort of looked at, oh, actually, no, when people give us some sort of like identification or like a description, we need to maybe be looking more into the identity of these criminals. And that's why ultimately he ends up writing lots of books and stuff, but he's the one that looks into things like eyes and noses and mouths and shapes of faces. And that's when everything okay. takes a turn and we end up with things like mugshots, and he's the one that wants to keep it all on file.
Okay.
Because obviously now it seems normal to us that we've got a file of criminals, but back in the 1800s that wasn't a thing.
I'm not sure if I've heard like something about him before.
He's very, like he's a founding father and everything, so he's very important in terms of criminology. So obviously record keeping for the time wasn't brilliant, and many criminals were evading capture by simply changing their name, moving away, or altering their appearance in terms of like, just, I don't know, putting a hat on or something. it sounds silly, but that's literally how they got away with it.
Or shaving a mustache off.
Yeah. So Alphonse studied the physical characteristics of people, working on the idea that you could narrow down the number of possible suspects by using data about them. He started taking notes on things such as the size of their heads, distance between eyes, and lengths of fingers. Though criminals could cut their hair and shave off beards and cover up tattoos, they couldn't alter their physical characteristics. Then using the newly developed technology that was photography, he started photographing and recording that along with the data, which was then indexed and could now be used to cross-reference to enable suspects to be tracked down quicker. So this is the first time that he's creating files on people. Up until this point, it'd never been done. So ultimately, Alphonse invented the mugshot, though he named it Portrait Parlé or Speaking Portraits.
I like the parlé.
Yeah.
It's a pirate thing, isn't it?
And it's weird because it does speak levels because you've got like all the information about the people. So I thought it was quite clever. I like it. Then in 1893, an Austrian magistrate named Hans Gross published Criminal Investigations, a practical handbook for magistrates, police officers and lawyers. Very long-winded title.
I thought his name was going to be Hans Granz.
No, I did. When I was thinking about your episode the other day, every time I was writing it, I was like, Hans Granz.
Hans Granz. Such a strange name.
So he was one of the founders of criminal profiling, and together with French criminologist Edmond Lockhart, they set out the new guidelines for pioneering CSI. So they set out three essential principles. Number one, the isolation of the crime scene. Number two, the systematic excavation of material evidence. And number three, the establishment of a system for ensuring that all evidence was carefully logged, retained and kept intact on its journey through the criminal justice system.
Okay.
So obviously this is what we look at now. It's just standard preserving your crime scene, all of that lot, collecting your evidence, making sure it's stored correctly in the police station. Hans Gross was adamant that one person, now known as the investigating officer, should be in charge of any crime scene and take responsibility for it. He must be an observant and persistent person, and Hans warned against holding preconceptions and taking things at face value. A good investigating officer had to be able to see beyond the obvious. Okay.
That's a very good,
Very good. So one of Gross's innovations was the use of the microscope, which would allow investigators to examine particles of dust invisible to the naked eye. And that also applied for fibres. So obviously that opened up a whole new wealth of evidence for police to use. So soon to be published would be Arthur Conan Doyle's fiction, Sherlock Holmes, and the exploits of the Baker Street detective captured Victorian readers and actually helped create a positive image of detection in the minds of the public. Many had previously perceived plainclothes officers to be spies. So people are still very superstitious at this time. So if someone's coming around asking questions, we're like, I'm not opening you out, mate. But after this whole Arthur Conan Doyle, after the Sherlock Holmes, everyone started to become interested in crime.
I think that's a good thing about like literature. It's very good at like getting people interested in something that they wouldn't necessarily be interested in.
To me, when I look at that, when those books came out, that would have been our equivalent of like, now we have true crime podcasts and documentaries. That was their equivalent.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden everyone's like, ooh, like when they're looking at things like, ooh, this could be part of a crime. Like people are more, I think, willing to come forward with bits and thinking, I must be able to give them a good description and things like that. Up until that point, they didn't have it. And people are becoming conscious of like, oh, well, this could be evidence, whereas no one did before. No one preserved anything.
No, they're just so, like, yeah, come on in.
In a weird way, I think it helped.
Of course it did.
Okay, so Edmond Lockhart's work was then taken on and developed by French criminologist Dr. Jean-Alexandre Eugène Lassange. Very long name. He was the head of the Department of Legal Medicine at the University of Lyon. He developed a system for matching a bullet found at a crime scene to the gun that had fired it. He also was able to calculate the length of time that a body had been putrefying for.
Oh.
This now enabled detectives to determine a time of death. So up until this point...
Putrefying.
Yeah. So in 1886, he founded a journal which showcased innovations in criminal investigations from around the world. In it, he discussed that by dissecting bodies of the victims of murder and those supposed to have died of natural causes, he was able to solve a number of murder cases, and that eventually led to the conviction of French serial killer Joseph Vaucher. So up until this point, like I said before, they weren't just doing autopsies. It wasn't a normal thing to do. And he was proving by taking some of those natural causes ones, or what they believed to be natural causes, that actually something a bit more fishy was going on.
Yes, not so natural.
Mm.
If you so are helped.
It helped in the long run by... Because I think it was more part of it was still everyone was very religious. And it's like, we don't want you to ruin these people's bodies.
Yeah.
Don't want you chopping them up.
Mm.
But he proved that actually in some cases it might be vital, especially if there's nothing else... strikingly obvious going on, because things like skull fractures,
oh yeah, you're not gonna,
you wouldn't have noticed.
No.
But you might just think, oh, the person tripped and fell and died, oh, that's unfortunate.
Mm.
Actually, they've been bashed over the head by something. Okay, so now for fingerprinting. In 1870, Dr. Henry Folds became convinced that each person's fingerprints were unique, and soon succeeded in exonerating an assumed criminal on the basis that his fingerprints differed from those discovered at the crime scene. So very fortunate for that individual criminal. He contacted Charles Darwin to ask him to help him work on his ideas. However, Darwin declined, and instead Francis Galton took on the work. Henry Folds published a paper on fingerprint identification in a magazine called Nature, and in 1886 offered his knowledge to the police in London. However, they stupidly dismissed it.
Yeah, well, it's strange that Darwin kind of like dismissed it as well.
Yeah, maybe he didn't think it was going to be that serious at the time. We've gone all this time and managed without. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or maybe he just wasn't very interested.
I don't know.
He was obviously more interested in the evolution of other animals and other things rather than crime. I don't know. Maybe he wasn't a crime fan. I don't know.
Maybe not. He wasn't a true crime. No.
So London police were using the system created by Alphonse Bertillon and did not see the need to introduce fingerprinting. So as far as they're concerned, Alphonse's idea of the whole photographing and mugshots, that was like, it blew their mind. That's all they need. Now that we've got this, there's no other... This will solve every crime. We don't need any other thing. Yeah. The fingerprinting, what use is that going to be? It's
Every time you touch something... you're going to leave evidence behind.
Yeah.
Your face isn't going to do that.
Yeah. So, and like I said, the face thing works until someone can't provide a description.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's fingerprints at the crime scene.
And like you said, all the people that you've seen of like their e-fits, whatever, they never look like the person that they're describing.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's very... they obviously didn't see how important it was at the time.
Yeah, they're just like, this is enough, thanks.
Yeah. So this work was kind of underground. Like, it was sat there, they had plenty of evidence to use it, they just weren't using it. Then in 1888, Francis Galton submitted a Royal Institution paper on the fingerprinting patterns without crediting Henry Folds. And in 1892, his book was published. In said book, he demonstrated that the chance of two sets of fingerprints being identical was about 1 in 64 billion. And for a long time, Francis was given the credit as establishing fingerprinting. However, it was technically Henry Folds that has done it. It's just Galton, it obviously worked alongside him, then kind of stole his work.
It's a bit of shit.
Mm. But it's okay, because we've discovered it now, so we can give Henry the credit for it.
Good.
So, obviously, it's a bit hard because that's kind of it for today's episode. There's obviously a lot more that goes on in the next couple of years, but because there was so much going on in the early 1900s, it kind of needs to be its own episode. So if people have enjoyed this episode, I'm probably going to do another one, but I might do the 1900s kind of decade by decade, because it massively advances in terms of changing how things go. And I think for this episode, I might, in the Instagram post, include some of the photos from
Idea. I think it's also, it's very interesting of like how it changed everything.
Yeah. Like, so up until this point, we really didn't have anything. They didn't really dive into cases. I think a lot of murders, like I kind of said to you before we started this episode, it was like tit for tat, like family, like one person killed one, and that was it. Then obviously in the early 1800s, the Industrial Revolution happens, which completely changes how people live. And rather than there being lots of rural areas with little family feuds, we have major cities cropping up, and people get jealous and have other agendas, and some people are making money and some people aren't. And it's a case of then crimes that weren't happening before are now happening, and they're going undetected. So, but we didn't have a police force. A lot of it, I think the police, it wasn't police how we know it today. It was just a group of volunteers.
Yeah.
And this was like probably part-time or something. Like they were doing it for free. They were just like, I don't know, maybe there was a person that roamed the corner of the streets as a police officer. And if a crime happened, they were like, is there a police officer? And then that was it. And then the volunteer police person would come and do it. They'd solve the crime there and then, and if there wasn't any about, basically the crime didn't get solved.
Yeah,
so and as time goes on, people start being murdered and they're like, meh, I should probably do something about this.
So if you wanted to commit a crime, the early 1800s
was a good one for you.
Yes.
Yeah, once you've hit like sort of mid 1820s, that's when they start developing.
So before then, you're good.
Get away with it.
Now,
to be fair, even mid 1800s, they haven't developed it that much. So they create a team.
Mm.
But I don't think the team really know what they're doing.
Probably not.
So, and I think, like I said, half of them are ex-convicts.
Yeah, that's not going to...
I mean, I get it. I think sometimes for some of them, if maybe they were a petty criminal, it might have been enough to turn them around because now they had a job and an income.
Yeah, but my episode from the other week...
Yeah.
He was a criminal and he was an informant.
Former, yeah.
And he used that just to find more victims.
Yeah.
So it's not... always
it's not
good.
Brilliant, no. And obviously like this, after we create our detective department over here, and then a few years, like 20 years later, we're like, oh wait, half of these are involved in a betting scam, so you know, we have to create another crime unit. It's like now when you look at the modern crime dramas, you know, like Line of Duty and all that lot, where it's like uncovering corrupt police. It still goes on now.
Of course it does,
because
it's never not going to be corrupt.
Yeah. So there's always going to be someone up to something that they shouldn't be up to.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I think it's weird how we went from not even really having a police force to then very quickly having a police force, but it was all one big group.
Yeah.
To then we decided, oh, actually, we should have departments and put people in sections and give them a specific job.
It's just interesting how, like, we figure things out.
Mm.
So, like, oh, this, like, now we understand, like, this is the protocol. But then back then they're just like, should we do it this way?
I think that's it. Like, so much changes between 18 and 1900. Like, massive things. Obviously, we invent things like microscopes, all that stuff. We didn't have any of that before, so it wasn't even an option. Once you start creating those things, it opens up a whole new field of stuff. Like, same with us in the late 1900s, we obviously developed things like DNA and things like that. It massively changes what we're able to do, and it's so easy to go back and solve other things. You think, God, if only we'd had this before. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems so obvious.
I think it's also, it shows that there's always more to discover, even now.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many thoughts. Like, there's bits where we can get it, but we're not quite there. Like, I think it's more now we're able to take samples from such small amounts, whereas even you think in early days you needed a pretty hefty blood stain to be able to extract the DNA, or you needed a good amount of DNA. As time's gone on, we can do it now with less and less things. Like, almost the DNA they can leave behind could be not visible by the naked eye, and we can now pick it up and detect the DNA, whereas before, like I said, it had to be really obvious. It had to be like a blood stoked t-shirt or something. Go, oh yeah, okay, there's some DNA there. And if it wasn't completely soaked in blood, we'd be like, oh no, that's useless, that is.
Probably just like, oh, that's paint. No, yeah. It's a very good case.
It
today.
Is, and I think it surprised me as well. There were certain aspects of it as I didn't realise how... It's weird, like, once they got going with it, they came up with stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah, that, I think that's why it was so interesting, because like someone like started and then it's like, oh, this person starting, this person, and then this person. Everyone's building up little
and
things.
And I don't know why, but I thought the mugshots was much later. I've kind of had in my head that it was like 1930s or something. I don't know why, because we already had like a kind of video camera by 20s, didn't we? Because we were recording bits, you know, like you think of like shows and stuff in like Hollywood. So it would make sense that they've already got mugshots. But I don't know why I associated it with it being something in the 1920s and 1930s, not the 1800s.
Probably because you're thinking of the movies.
Yeah,
so therefore, cameras.
Yeah.
Mugshots.
But yeah, I thought it's obviously very clever for someone to just sit there and think, okay, this is what we need. Like, it seems kind of obvious to us now, but I suppose to everyone else, if that's not how your life was, like, you think society as a whole was completely different.
Yeah. Even now, think about, like, how me taking a photo of you, I have it. Like, how?
Yeah, I know. It's weird, isn't it?
It's like, you're there, but then you're also there. How?
I don't know. It's weird.
Magic.
It is magic. But, like, how? I just, you know, with these whole invention things, like, I think, like, oh, it's really cool that people discover these things. But then I'm also like,
how?
Like, how did they discover it? How? Is it an accident?
How do I take a photo and it's exactly as it is? How?
Maybe we need to look into the history of the camera, like how they actually discovered it, because I feel like a lot of these things, it's got to be pure accident.
Yeah, of course it is,
because you, I don't think someone sits down and goes, I want to be able to take
a photograph.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't have even called it photograph. No. It's called photograph later. It's like, I want to take a bit of that person's face and be able to keep it forever and ever, but I don't want to have to chop the head off.
Yeah,
is that how it was? I don't know.
I have no idea.
And they're like, I want to be able to remember this person, how they looked before.
And then like mirrors is a bit more, I understand a bit more mirrors, but it's strange.
Yeah, when did you decide, like, I want to be able to see what I look like?
Yeah. Is it Narcissus? Narcissus? I don't know how to say
it. I don't know. Maybe.
It's where narcissists come
either
from.
Either that, or there was a lonely person. It's like, I need to ask someone what my clothes look like, but there's no one else here, so, you know, I need to find a way to be able to look myself.
Is it the Greek tragedy of Narcissus? Or however you say his name. Like, he falls in love with his own reflection in the stream or whatever it is. Yeah, he can't look away from it at all times.
Most beautiful thing I've ever seen. But that's what he says. The ugliest person.
Well, that's the first time he's seen himself, so.
But yeah, no, it's really interesting. And like in the book as well, I should have brought it with me today so I could have showed you. But it's basically this Alfonsi guy, he prints out a thing and it's like loads of people's like eyes and then eyebrows and bridges of noses. And it's like the really early photography. And it's what he does. He creates like a little book with all these things. And then he does like little annotations next to it. And he's like, that's how he does. He goes like, this characteristic matches like this. And he obviously does a lot of profiling as time goes on. But I just thought it was really interesting for the time. It seemed very advanced in a weird way. But yeah, no, I thought it was quite interesting. So there's a lot going on between 1900 and 1910. A hell of a lot changes. And it completely changes. I think not, it's like how serial killers come about, because serial killers have already been around because we've had Jack the Ripper. But I don't think serial killers is really a thing until the 1900s. And that obviously then, again, massively shifts how they have to preserve things in terms of deciding to link crimes. Because at this point, they're still not linking crimes.
So yeah, I think you should definitely do some episodes of those.
I just thought it's a very interesting book, and it's also given me inspiration for lots of other cases, because once it goes into the introduction of it, it literally lists like there's pages of major cases across the whole of Europe and yeah, some of those cases. So there's, I think there's one I sent to you, a name of one. But yeah, there's a few of them that I've seen that I'm like, ooh, this seems really interesting. So I kind of want to go back over and look at the different cases. So it's given me lots of cases to do anyway.
That's a good thing.
I've got plenty of content for the next few years. There you go. You're stuck with me for a few years at the very least.
Good.
So there'll be lots more Victorian and early. What is the 1900s once we're past? What is after Victorian times? What are we like?
George? Is it George after Victoria?
I thought Edwardian and Georgian was before Victorian. Maybe I've made that up. I might be wrong.
Wasn't George the fifth?
Oh, yeah. So is it Edwardian, Victorian, Georgian?
Yeah,
I don't know. Might be making up. I could be wrong.
I have no idea, because like, what are we? What are we?
I don't know, because it's weird. Because like, we've had like millennials and Gen Z. Like, they seem to be like only a decade apart, whereas Victorians seem to last forever. Because that was like,
it goes on the monarchy.
Oh, okay. Oh, is it?
Yeah, Victorian. But Queen Victoria.
Yeah, but that was for ages. But then Queen Elizabeth was alive and queen for ages. But we've had multiple.
Yeah.
generations. We've had millennial, Gen Z.
Yeah, but in history, I think we would be looked at as like in the monarchy, not Gen Z. Well, I think it that's what differentiates.
Okay. I don't know. I'm very confused.
I think as a monarchy.
Like Victorian
system.
Seems really early because I think it's like it's 1830s or 1840s is so when from Victorian.
When she starts her reign to when she ends her reign.
Okay.
Which is why it's called a Victorian.
Okay.
And Edward.
Because the early 1800s wasn't Victorian. Mm. It's just before Victorian. But I can't remember if Edwardian's before.
I think it is. Victorian. And then it's Victorian.
Yeah. It's very confusing. And then I should probably check this.
Yes.
Wait, let me Google it now while I'm here.
Okay.
Because I think it's very confusing.
For the world, it's like millennial, Gen Z, but then for English people, it would go by the monarchy, I think. But then when it gets down to it, it'll be the millennial and the Gen Z.
Okay. So, what period is the Victorian era? Okay, so Victorian era is 1837 to 1901.
Mm-hmm.
Then let me put in Edwardian. Because it's like, you know when you look at houses, then. It's like Edwardian houses, and you're like, mm-hmm.
That'd be before Victoria, then.
No, it's not.
Is it
it's
not?
After. 1901 to 1910. So it's only 9 years.
That's a very short year.
Yeah, that's why I was confused. Is it before?
So is Edward her dad then?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. I thought her dad was George. Was George the one who abdicated?
Abdicated,
okay, that's
yeah.
Why. Okay. But yeah, I think that's it for today.
Hang on, let me check the Georgian era before we disappear. No, see, Georgian was before Victorian. So it's Georgian, Victorian, Edwardian.
Okay.
I thought Georgian was after.
What's... Elizabeth's reign. Elizabethan part two.
So, wait, Georgian is 1714 mm-hmm. to 1830. So that's mm-hmm. like a massive long one, the Georgian era.
So what's the queen that's just died, what's her reign called?
That's what I'm saying. But it's not, it's like we went from Edwardian.
You're not telling me what her
reign
called.
No, I'm not, because it's not doing in order. I had to type in Edwardian. So what era is after Victorian?
It was...
Oh, Edwardian, yeah. So... What era follows Edwardian?
Yeah.
Modern era. What?
Because there is a Elizabethan. So, and yeah, it's happening
before,
and it's technically
isn't that end
happening
of Tudors
now.
Elizabethan?
Yeah, and also technically this one is happening now. So I don't think they can name it until after it's passed. Maybe? So we're the modern... Okay.
Oh, wait, there's modern one, modern two. Okay, so periods in history. So Victorian was obviously 1837 to 1901. Then Edwardian is 1901. Oh, here it's saying 1914, but the other one said 1910. Take that however you want to take it. Modern, 1914 to 1945. Modern two is 1945 to 2000. Okay. Mm. And then... Oh, it's gone down. Yeah, it's... I don't know, I don't get it. So, then are we, like, millennial? No, I'm very confused.
Unless they're not going to count the royals in the reigns going forward. I don't know.
I don't know how they do it.
I don't know how they decide. No, me neither.
Because, obviously, Queen Elizabeth... But because they've already had Elizabethan, can they not call it... Elizabethan times again, so that's why I went with modern one and modern two.
Yeah, because like there's Tudor times because there's so many Henrys.
Yeah,
so wouldn't that be
and
the
Stuart.
Windsor? Yeah, wouldn't it be Windsor because she's Windsor?
No, they've called it modern one and modern two.
Yeah, but I mean like in the future, like once we're out of the modern, once we're dead and people are looking back at history, would
well,
we
won't
classed?
Know Natasha because we'll be dead.
But I want to know. Windsor would make sense, I think. The Windsor period or whatever it's called.
It sounds weird though. The other sound better.
Do you want to know the real one? The Mountbatten is what they're actually called. I think there's a Greek name as well.
Baton era.
Mountbatten.
It just makes you think of a mini baguette.
I am actually hungry. But yeah, I think that's it for today.
Yeah, now we got massively distracted at the end. If anyone knows the actual answer to what era we're in.
Apparently the modern one.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because we are actually living it currently.
Well, yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. In the meantime,
keep creeping.
And we'll keep digging.